Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS and European recognized specialist in veterinary neurology and neurosurgery, Alberta De Stefani. Thank you, Alberta. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, Sammy. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you for joining the webinar today. The topic, as you can see from the title, is seizures, a common sense approach to it that I feel is what really we all need when facing with these patients. So the outcome of this webinar will be really ultimately more comfortable in differentiating between what is a seizure and what is more a paroxysmal episode, so another funny turn, as often the owner tend to describe it. And to be also be more confident in localizing and defining the cause of the seizures, and ultimately to try to choose the best workup that isn't quite the same for all the seizure patients, and then the treatment, best treatment for our patients. So what are seizures? Seizures are essentially very major electrical storms for the brain, and that's the way I think is easy to remember it. Now, if we really want to go into a more classic and scientific definition, it's essentially the manifestation of a hypersynchronous activity or neuronal activity in the cerebral cortex. So brain doesn't do very well with synchronization. That's why a hypersynchronous activity is detrimental. And seizures are this imbalance between having too much excitation and not enough inhibition. So if a seizure is a hypersynchronous activity of the brain, it might just be worth trying to clarify what the normal cortical activity looks like. And the way I like to see it is essentially, if you were to fly over a city at night time and you look down, you will probably see a constant flickering of light. Not all lights are on at the same time in all area, and not lights are all off at the same time, and there will be area with more light and area with less light. So this constant flickering of turning on and off of lights that we can see when we fly over a city really mimic and represent what the cerebral cortex normal function is. So if you imagine all those lights being on at the same time, then that is what we define this hypersynchronization that eventually will lead to the seizure activity. So the other key point, I think, to keep in mind from the start is that seizures are only symptoms. It's no more, no less than saying vomiting or saying lameness or cough. So there are so many differentials for this condition I just mentioned. The same really applies for seizures. So seizures are not really a diagnosis, but a symptom. And you have here two images, T1 post contrast and T2 weighted transverse images of a dog with a brain tumor, but it doesn't have to be a brain tumor. It can be also a metabolic derangement, for example, a toxic insult that causes seizures. So we cannot really stop just with saying, oh, well, my patient is having seizures. We really need to dig deeper and trying to find the cause of it. There are, I don't really have to say this, one of the most common neurological problems that are encountered in general practice, and is more or less estimated that every 130 patients that walk through a general practice door, there will be one with a presentation or a complaint of seizure. So certainly a very, very relevant and prevalent condition out there. For cats, the prevalence is a lot less clear, and what we can say is it represents about 2% of the referral cat hospital population. So, what do we do when we are presented with a patient with seizures? Well, I think having a logical approach, and you probably heard before about this clinical reasoning, I think is really, really important. And you might be, aware or not that there are different type of reasonings that we can have. There is the more analytical one, that is this clinical reasonings. You go through step by step, you create the problem list, you try to define the problem, define the system involved, and then the location and eventually the lesion. And there is a more it's called type one reasoning, that is more like a pattern recognition and is an unconscious type of reasoning. So we can't really avoid, we can't stop from doing so. I think often we do use in our day-to-day clinic this pattern recognition, and in a sense, it's not completely wrong to do so. But we also have to be fully aware that not everything that looks, for example, like a seizure is a seizure, and that we might really need to review our work hub, essentially. To get to the bottom of the problem. So the first important step really will be to differentiate seizure from paroxysmal. It all starts really from here. And how can we do so? So if we can have a look at the first video, Sammy. Here we go. So what you see here is obviously a B shown, and it's having some, I would say, abnormal motor activity. And you can see the contraction of the left thoracic and left pelvic limb. It's turning, the body is turning to the left side as well. But the mentation of the dog is appropriate. Of course, you were not there, but it was responding to his name. He was quite happy to look around. The dog went past, and he turned to see what was happening next door. So, although there was this very diffuse and very severe impairment in his motor activity, his mentation appeared to be completely normal. Here is him almost recovering. And then the other side starts. So, is this a seizure? Well, up front it might be difficult to distinguish it, but one feature that really can help us is that the mentation is completely preserved. And we would normally assume that if a seizure is severe enough to involve the motor activity on one side of the body, and in this case, both sides of the body, then there should also be a degree of mentation impairment. So, is this a seizure? It's very unlikely. This is more likely to be a form of dyskinesia. If we can move on to the next video. This is obviously a different breed. It's a Labrador, is a young Labrador that presented also with a history of funny turns, as often they are defined. And so he is a very happy dog otherwise, but intermittently and sadly, with no warning, is developing this, again, inability to control movement. And you will see in a minute, it really try to push through this episode and wants to, carry on life as normal, but ultimately will lie down. And again, also in this case, his mentation is completely normal and is preserved all along. And we can see a pattern that is very similar to what you saw on the B shown. There is this contraction, tonic contraction of the right pelvic limb in this case and left pelvic limb. And almost like a body sway, you can really see the body really wobbling and the head wobbling from one side to the other. So, is this a seizure? Again, very unlikely so. It's a lot more likely to be a form of paroxysmal dyskinesia. And there are so many of these episodes, it doesn't really have to be always a dyskinesia. Sometimes episodic vestibular attack can be really difficult to distinguish from seizures, syncope, some form of narcolepsy. There are so many episodes out there. So we really need to try to navigate our way through these. And we'll see in a few slides that there are a few key features that we might just need to look out for. And if we now play the video of the little Dachshunds, you will see how these is a completely different episode. We still have that tonic contraction of the right pelvic line, but we do have this paddling movement. We have some jaw chomping, and you can just about see there are some, you know, some wetness around the mouth. And again, you don't hear the audio in this case, but the little dog is completely non-responsive to the environment. So this, obviously, as distressing as it is for the owner, not just for the owner, also for us really to see, represent generalized tonic-clonic seizures. So features that are, you know, completely different would be this mentation, the presence of autonomic sign. You can really see this patch of saliva that really is at the around the mouth of the dog. So let's move to the next slide and we can stop the video. So the first thing that we want to do, basing really our approach through the clinical reasoning, is to construct a list of problems that the patient is presenting with, and then really trying to define and refine what the problem is. And like we said, first question is the event truly a seizure? Because if it is, then the workup will be one. If it isn't, then we'll have to obviously think about what else we can do. So how can we really distinguish it? And I absolutely agree. Sometimes it's very, very difficult. Sometimes you don't have the certainty until you do either more investigations or trial treatment. So it's not always black and white. But the history, of course, is very important. And now that you know, you can with a phone record almost everything, owners do come with video recording of these episodes, these paroxysmals that the patient is having. And that helps so much in really assessing what the feature of the episodes are. And on all the description, often enough, it's difficult to know if he's conscious, not conscious, if which sort of motor activity there is, and so on and so forth. And then the video can really clarify that in just a few seconds. So I would definitely encourage anyone that is seeing a patients that have these episodes to ask for a video of it. And we're always more than happy to assess videos and feedback what we think on that. The other important thing is that seizures, to be so, need to really follow a sort of a pattern. And where the prodrome and the aura don't always are not always present, or the owner might not be really recognizing this this part. The ictal phase, so a clear description or video of the ictal phase, and particularly what happened after the episode is very, very important. Seizures tend to have a postictal phase. If an episode comes out of the blue, causes a lot of trouble to the dog, for example, like in the Bichon or in the Labrador we've seen before, and then the moment the episode is over, the dog just carries on life as before, like nothing happened, that doesn't really tick all the boxes for seizures, leaving alone the, you know, the mentation. But patients that recover extremely quickly or really snap out of the episode and carry on as normal possibly has less chances of having a seizure than maybe a different form of episode. So the postictal phase is something really to watch out, as well as a clear description or video of the ictal phase. And then the physical examination. Of course, if you do a physical and you find a really severe arrhythmia or pulse deficits, then certainly that helps you addressing, and maybe, you know, this episode aren't seizure after all, but maybe more syncopal type of events. And again, the neuroexamination that we know very well can be completely normal, but if you do find neurological deficits, to have lateralized neurological deficits, that can definitely support that, you know, it's like to be neurological, it's like to be in the brain, and that kind of leads to a certain set of tests and workup. So defining and refining the system, well, this is probably the easiest part when we talk about seizures, because there is only one part of the body that can cause the seizure or can trigger the seizure and is the brain, particularly the forebrain. But like we said before, although seizures are events that originate in the brain, the cause of the seizure is what we need to really dig and find out because the cause of seizure can be many and different. And what we normally define is that there are intracranial and extracranial causes for seizures. And if we look at the intracranial causes, we'll probably include the idiopathic form of epilepsy and the structural one, so any structural abnormality of the brain parenchyma itself. And then the reactive seizures that obviously are extracranial and can be toxic and be metabolic in origin. If we look at the definition of idiopathic epilepsy, you probably have heard about the International Veterinary Epilepsy Task Force. It's a group of neurologists that sat down all together from all around the world and decided to standardize language and all about epilepsy. And this is for ease of communication and also to make sure we are all using the same language, all describing things in the same way. So what they decided to do was to really give some definitions. Idiopathic epilepsy have been used in various ways over the years, but right now the way we use it is as an overarching term that include the genetic form of epilepsy and the, let me just this. So there are a couple of genes that have been identified so far as a causative of seizures, but idiopathic also can be used in those forms of epilepsy where a breed has a high prevalence. And again, there is a nice publication if you're interested that can tell you exactly the breeds where the prevalence has been established above 2% and therefore are prone to idiopathic epilepsy. And then epilepsy is also used in those cases where a cause for the seizure is not being identified. So nothing new really, but it just gives us some ground and we can safely use this terminology now. Regarding the structural epilepsy, like we said before, anything that is altering the normal structure of the brain can potentially trigger a seizure, particularly if the gray matter, so the cortex is involved. And then we have the reactive form of seizures that again is a reaction of a normal brain to either a metabolic or a toxic insult. And again, the International Veterinary Epilepsy Task Force stressed the fact that it's not a form of epilepsy. And because epilepsy is a disease of the brain and reactive seizures are is a reaction of the normal brain. So the brain is not diseased in a reactive form of seizures. Then it's a bit of pedantic definition, but we talk about reactive seizures, not reactive epilepsy. For this reason, if we look at the overall causes of seizures, then we can see that idiopathic epilepsy represent a vast majority, over 40%. But reactive and structural epilepsy, particularly the reactive, takes on a good third of the cause, the general causes of seizure, and the structural epilepsy about a quarter. If now we look at the metabolic or toxic cause of seizures, we can see that intoxication and hypoglycemia are probably the more common causes of reactive seizures. And then another point to maybe highlight is that if we look at the electrolyte disorders, hypocalcemia was the most frequently identified abnormalities. So certainly is worth considering those reactive seizures as a cause of the seizure that the patient presents, and always think about hypoglycemia as a differential. The classification is not just in terms of the etiology, but we know that seizure can present as generalized and focal, and they can present as a single one every so often in clusters, so more than two seizures in 24 hours, or in a form of status epilepticus or continuous seizure activity. Generalized and focal doesn't really add much onto the etiology. There are, some thoughts that perhaps focal seizures with secondary generalization might just support more a structural or lateralizing issue in the brain. That's not always the case. So I think we should really stay very much open-minded and then do eventually further investigation if there is an indication for this. If we can have the video of the boxer with a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. Here we have similar really to the episode that you've seen in the Dachshund. This dog is displaying the very typical generalized tonic-clonic seizures with associated autonomic signs. And you see the profuse hypersalivation there. You see there is a mixture of tonic and tonic-clonic movements of the limbs, and mentation is completely affected. And I think we can stop. The video is really distressing, but the typical feature of a generalized tonic-clonic seizures, apart from the type of contraction or intermittent contraction, flexion of the limb muscles, is the loss of consciousness, as well as the autonomic signs. Although they might not be always very obvious, we always talk about, episodes that are associated with autonomic signs like urination, defecation during an episode of unconscious hypersalivation, certainly do support your generalized tonic-clonic seizure. But sometimes the autonomic signs might just be dilation of the pupil. There's obviously something very difficult for the owner to identify and very difficult to see in a video unless the owner goes really close by or unless the seizure happened while the patient is in hospital and you can check for that. But it's not something that we always go in and look. They often snap during the episode, so not quite easy to see. But the fact that the patient is not urinating or defecating, there is not profuse hypersalivation, doesn't mean there are no autonomic signs. There might be, they might just be more difficult to spot. But these are probably the main features of the generalized tonic-clonic seizure. If then we move to a focal form of seizure, and you can see this giant schnauzer. And of course, it's a black dog, has to be. But you can see there is a degree of twitching of the face. We might be able to run the video again, maybe. And you can see there is this twitching of the face, some jerking movement of the neck muscle, and then possibly almost like a collapse to the right side. And then the dog perks up and carries on. Really walk in. So this is a focal seizure. A focal seizure can look like anything from the twitch to the face to the jerk of a group of muscles. So they are a lot more maybe difficult to identify. Usually less distressing for the owner to witness, although not necessarily a lot more benign for the brain really to have, particularly if they happen in clusters. But certainly, the focal seizures compared to the generalized one don't always affect mentation. And in this case, you could argue that toward the end, when there is this partial collapse, that there was a moment where the dog wasn't so responsive. So focal seizure might have impaired consciousness, but is a lot less evident compared to obviously the generalized tonic-clonic. And obviously, there are often movement or abnormal movement, twitching associated with it. There are also described in human, particularly this absent seizure or sensory seizures that only affect obviously the sensation. That could be a sound, could be a smell, and it's very difficult, obviously, to identify this type of seizures in our patients. But certainly, if there is focal muscle activity plus or minus impaired consciousness, that again tick a little box for focal seizure activity. If then we look at trying to define and localize, we know the system that causes a seizure is the brain. We know that that might be a reaction to a metabolic or toxic insult, or could be due to an intracranial issue. But how do we, how do we navigate our way through it? So, obviously, everything that we do with our patient in terms of history, taking signalment, video, physical and neurological examination and potentially, you know, a minimum blood database is going to help us identify if there is an intracranial problem or not. And we can put that really to the test. So let's see this case example. Cass is a 2 years old female neutered Labrador that has a 4 month history of generalized seizures with autonomic signs, and more or less she seizures once a month, and the duration of the seizure is relatively short, around a minute, and then it takes a little while to come around and be back to normal. But the owner reports that she's completely normal in between events, and her physical and neurological examination are completely normal when she presents. So what do you think is the most likely cause of Cass's seizure? And here, I'm sure you will use both your pattern recognition and your clinical reasoning, because a young Labrador that present with these clinical signs, certainly, you know, if you answer A, idiopathic epilepsy, you have very, very high chances to be absolutely right. And so the fact that her near exam was normal, the fact that physically physical examination was normal, that she was normal in between events, and her age and signalment all fitted really with a typical pattern of an idiopathic epileptic dog. And if we look at where idiopathic epilepsy is more likely is in young adults, so between 6 months and 6 years, and typically normal in the interictal period with a normal near exam, as long as it's not really close to a seizure, and they are metabolically normal. And possibly the most typical are the generalized tonic-clonic seizures. The International Epilepsy Task Force has also given us some further help in terms of how confident we are that we are really dealing with an idiopathic epileptic dog. So a dog that presents like Cassie with those, is a young adult, normal otherwise, and has generalized tonic-clonic seizures, is likely to have idiopathic epilepsy. And you can increase your level of confidence just by doing more tests. So a tier one level of confidence is what we've just said, so fits the typical features and doesn't have any abnormalities on a kind of basic blood test. And discretional really are to perform bile acid and T4 and B12. So you could well say, well, Cassie is a young dog and I've done my bloods and everything is completely normal. I'm confident that I'm dealing with idiopathic epilepsy. And this can just stop here. So you don't have to necessarily perform a further investigation as long as you remain with an open mind. And if things do change over time, then you use your clinical reasoning again and might just redefine the problem or the lesion. To increase your level of confidence that you're dealing truly with idiopathic epilepsy, you could do everything that is present in the tier one, as well as fasting and postprandial bile acids and an MRI of the brain, so advanced imaging and spinal tap analysis. So obviously this certainly helps further ruling out that there are no structural causes for these seizures and increases your level of confidence. The high level of confidence is doing everything in tier one and tier two, as well as performing an EEG. And this ultimately can confirm the presence of seizure activity. MRI hopefully has ruled out that there are no structural issues, and then you are as confident as you will ever be probably that this is a case of idiopathic epilepsy. If we move to a case two, we have Buster that is 9 years old and is a male neuter boxer and has a completely different history, really. So we have disorientation. So the owner doesn't perceive that Buster is completely normal. There is pacing, potentially some circling, and if he circles, he's more to the right side. And had also generalized tonic-clonic seizures and some of these seizures have occurred in a cluster. His physical examination is normal, and we have now a couple of videos, one of his gait, one of the cranial nerves, and you can just observe what's happening. So there isn't much of a menace there. Menace seems to be intact in the right eye. I think we can now move to the gait video. And here is Buster walking up and down. And that we can stop here. His gait is normal, and so we can stop the video. And then once we test the proprioception, you can see that there is reduced proprioception in his left pelvic limb. So we have a patient that has some degree of augmentation, or the owner reports it that is quieter than he normally is, that has a normal gait when he's walked on a straight line. So there is no ataxia or sensory deficits there. But if we do challenge him with some propositioning, then there is reduced proprioception in his left, and we know that there is a reduced menace in the left eye. So putting all these findings together, not just to pattern recognize, because the Labrador and is a boxer and is a certain age that it necessarily has to have an intracranial lesion. But let's say all these features really do point to a right forebrain disorder. So we know from the neuro exam that it was obtunder, there was circling, there was this absent menace, and we are really worried that he does not have idiopathic epilepsy, but it has more of a structural form of epilepsy. So if we have to pick a most likely cause, we would probably choose the option C as the most likely. So structural epilepsy is more common in patients that are less than 6 months or older than 6 years. And although the neurological examination can be normal, and this is because there are so many areas in the brain that are called silent, particularly in the frontal, prefrontal cortex, a lot can go on before we actually see neurological deficits. So we might see the seizures in the absence of anything else. And that almost represents a quarter of the patients with seizures. So we certainly need to stay open-minded. But if you do have neurological deficits, they are normally asymmetric, and that can really strongly point to an intracranial cause of your seizures. And typically, these patients are metabolically normal. And the type of seizures can be obviously focal or generalized. Now, I just put a care here, and this is because if we think about inflammatory CNS disease, so the MUA is the group of inflammatory conditions of a known origin that affects the brain, then they can happen at any age. So although we say, structural epilepsy is more likely in less than 6 months and older than 6 years, then let's, be mindful and again use our clinical reasoning, because inflammatory conditions can affect young adults as much as young patients or slightly older patients. So we really need to watch out for this condition. So we have now the third case, and is Sam, and is a 12-year-old Stuffy, and the owner says that Sam has been slowing down for a period of time, but they just put that down to the fact that he was getting older and had some facial twitchings and jerking, particularly in the morning, over a period of 2 months. And then from there he went on and developed generalized seizures. And apart from being a little bit quieter, the owner didn't perceive there were any abnormalities in between the seizures. And when we examined him, he was normal on the physical and neurological examination. So we can have a quick look at one of the videos of Sam. And you can really see there is a Literally a twitch and a jerk, particularly affecting face and neck muscles. Not very dissimilar to what was happening to the Jagdschnauzer, or the big black dog that we've seen earlier on. So these are just a set of episodes that the owner recorded. And on top of these, he also started to experience generalized seizures. And we can move on so we can start the video. So, what is the most likely cause of Sam's seizures? Well, can we say in this case, based on what we just said, he's an older patient, so let's say his chance of having idiopathic epilepsy unfortunately fall down slightly compared to a much younger patient. But we know his neurological examination was normal, apart from maybe be quieter. So does he have a structural form of epilepsy? We don't have any neurological deficits that we can use to support our idea of a structural disorder, but certainly is possible. We said that about 23% have a normal neuro exam, even with a structural brain disorder. But this type of seizure could well be also reactive. It is an older patient, and we know that unfortunately there are a set of conditions and cancer, obviously, on top of probably everything else that could cause metabolic derangements and seizures. So the next step in Sam's case will be to perform some basic bloods. That is what you would, I'm sure, normally do in these circumstances. And in his case, unfortunately, we found he was severely hypoglycemic, and he was diagnosed with a pancreatic nodule, and that was an insulinoma. So in his case, the seizures were reactive. But before running this blood test, it could have been either, he's an older patient, we know it could be reactive, it could be also structural. So reactive seizures it can, present at any age. Certainly, because we include toxic and metabolic in these reactive seizures, it could be a patient that's been scavenging, that has encountered or been exposed to any toxin, or it could be a metabolic derangement that can range from the protosystemic shunt that causes the encephalopathy and potential seizures to the hypoglycemia. We saw hypocalcemia also within those relatively common causes of reactive seizures. And I think we can move to the next slide. And we have a video here of a dog that is actually a young dog. We can run it again. Yes, it's a very short video presented as an emergency for severe trembling and generalized tonic-clonic seizures. And what the owner found was that it went into the compost bin and ate everything moldy that he could possibly find. So obviously being exposed to tremogenic mycotoxin that led to this presentation. So again, this is a very young dog. Sam was a very older patient, but just to stress the fact that reactive seizure can really happen at any age. And history in this case was very, very clear and didn't leave any doubt about what the cause of the seizure could have been. In some case, it needed the bloods really to be a little bit more confident into what we were dealing with. So the International Veterinary Epilepsy Task Force has also offered a plan, really, or how to approach this case and when is best to perform further investigation and a further workup. So we obviously know in the idiopathic epilepsy group, that we can increase our level of confidence from a tier one to a tier three according to what we feel is necessary, what the owner want to do, how anxious they are to find out. So in that case, it's left to the clinician and the owner discretion to perform more investigation. But what the task force suggests is that patients that are less than 6 months and older than 6 years will probably benefit benefit. If circumstances allow, there could be many and different, including obviously the financial situation. So if at all possible, patients that are younger than 6 months and older than 6 years might benefit from a further workup. Also, they say if the interictal neurological examination is abnormal, so if we have lateralizing signs, that certainly again suggests that looking into a potential structural cause of the seizure is a good idea if feasible. Patients that have experienced status epilepticus or cluster seizure, so kind of a more severe form of epilepsy, let's say, that certainly again is an indication to run further investigations, and this is very important. If you remember the first case that we saw, Cassie with idiopathic epilepsy, if we have a patient that we diagnose with a tier one level of confidence that is having idiopathic epilepsy, like Cassie, and we do the treatment, we start our antiepileptic regime, and the owner respects everything that we ask them to do, but the dog continues to have seizures. And we start then questioning that although the pattern really fitted beautifully with the idiopathic epilepsy patient, could it be that it has perhaps a congenital malformation? It could have hydrocephalus or porencephaly, or maybe it's developing an inflammatory disease that actually makes this seizure a lot more difficult to control. So this is another indication really to perform further investigations. The big question is also always when to start the antiepileptic treatment. Should we start it? Should we start it all the time? What to use, monotherapy or combination therapy from the start? Do we want to start a maintenance treatment, or do we want to lower the patient? So these are all questions that I think we face every time we see a patient that has seizures, almost regardless of the underlying cause. So the first question really would be, what do we want from our treatment? And I also put a question, is antiepileptic drug or treatment an adequate name? And again, it's a bit of a pedantic probably definition, but these drugs might help controlling the seizures, but they actually don't cure epilepsy, and that's why maybe we should use anti-seizure drugs more than anti-epileptic drugs. But again, it makes no difference, we all call it anti-epileptic drugs, and so we should stick with it. So let's have a look really at what the guidelines to initiate in treatment are, again, provided by this lovely group of people that sat together and worked very, very hard to produce this framework. So what they are saying is that if a patient has an interictal period of less than 6 months, then we should really consider starting a maintenance treatment for the seizures. Patients that have experienced status epilepticus or severe cluster seizures, then again, should be started on an antiepileptic treatment. And this is because, like we were saying before, this is a more severe form of epilepsy, and we are certainly worried that obviously status epilepticus is in itself a life-threatening condition. Cluster seizure are just a small step away from status epilepticus. So these patients, you would probably, even if it's the first status epilepticus they've ever experienced, if it's the first cluster of seizures they've experienced, you might want to get them on some medications that you can always withdraw in the future if things improve, or if they become seizure-free, if they never re-experience a seizure again. But it will probably be safer to start this patient on medication. Also, if the patient is experiencing very severe postictal signs, for example, being really, really aggressive or agitated, and there are those patients that really sometimes experience a postictal phase of hours, and they bash into everything, and it's very distressing and for the owner, and dangerous really potentially for the pet itself. So that's another indication to start an antiepileptic treatment. And then if the seizure is getting worse, so you have a patient that for actually been a number of years, had one, maybe two seizure a year, and then it starts to creep up and is seizuring every 2 3 months. Then that is an indication that perhaps you should start a seizure. Similarly, if the duration of the seizure is changing, so if it was a, you know, 1 minute seizure once a year, and then it start to become maybe a small cluster, even if the frequency isn't altered, or is becoming a 5 minute seizure that really is heading into status epilepticus, then you would probably consider starting treatment in that case also. What I would also add is if there are if there is a identifiable structural abnormality in the brain, so if the form of seizure is a structural form, so if there is a brain really a structural abnormality, I would probably suggest starting antiepileptic treatment because the dog or the cat has a very good reason to have further seizure in the future. And also some patients that experience head trauma present with a history of seizure at the time of the trauma or soon after the trauma, those patients would probably be better off on a at least temporary anti-epileptic treatment. So, which antiepileptic and at which dosage? And this is there is no one treatment that works for all, and this is the same, I think, for many different conditions, not just the seizure, and certainly not just antiepileptic drugs. So the treatment has to be really individualized, and every patient has a slight variability in the form they absorb and excrete the drug, and particularly they have a different sensitivity to the drug itself and might develop more or less side effects according to these. Also, the number of seizure and the frequency can really dictate which first choice drug are you going to use. And if you are loading the patients, or if the seizures are you know, relatively benign and you have time to start a maintenance treatment, then you would probably choose this this route. And one other key factor is the owner lifestyle, the compliance, and which demands really they have. And certainly it would be, you know, impossible to ask an owner that works all day out of the house to give a medication 3 times a day. Certainly that would complicate his life or her life dramatically and might reduce compliance. So we really have to, I think, communication and talking to owners of pet with seizures is a key to success. We certainly, you know, particularly if we're talking about idiopathic epilepsy, these are patients that will stay with us for the rest of their life. That hopefully is going to be a long life, and they will need a lot of checkups and adjustments. And the sooner you start explaining this to the owner, I think the more likely is that they will be on board and they will follow your instruction and they will be, you know, feeling in charge of the treatment as well, so part of the plan. So in terms of which drug we should use, well, there is this it's a pyramid of efficacy really that has been looked. It's a meta-analysis of all drugs that have been used in pets, and all papers have been published about this efficacy. And you can really see that phenobarbital and imipenem are at the top of the pyramid. So phenobarbital probably slightly higher compared to the imipenem, and these are the two reported most effective antiepileptic drugs that we have out there. To follow, there is potassium bromide, followed by levetiracetam, zonisamide, and many, many other antiepileptic drugs for which we have less scientific evidence, but you know, they're is a constant flow, particularly from the veterinary, from the human medicine that goes into the veterinary medicine. There are many, many drugs that are released, and we should really look into these other options. So the three drugs that are licensed, we know, are phenobarbital, potassium bromide, and imipenem. And then we tend to use them as first-line drug. And then there are the second-line drugs that are the levetiracetam, zonisamide, gabapentin, pregabalin. And really, this list is growing monthly. So we can just briefly really run through the common antiepileptics and see how they work, and not much because we really need to know everything about the pharmacodynamic and pharmacokinetic of these drugs, but more because if we use them, we should try to understand particularly where they work, particularly if we use them in combination. So if we just don't do a one drawback combination of drug, and it might just be very useful to know where these drugs work, at which level. So pheno, we know, is a GABA ergic drug, so attaches to the GABA receptors, and in this way opens up a chloride channel, so lets negative charges into the neuron. And if we look at this picture here, the benzodiazepine and barbiturate sit at this level here. They both really act on the GABA receptor, and we can see that the GABA attaches to the this receptor, opens up the chloride channel, and let the cell become more negative, so less likely to be hyperpolarized, and then to have a depolarization essentially. So this is the way phenobarbital works, and this is so it's acting at a postsynaptic level. And the dose, obviously, you can find in every single book or formulary. We would normally say anything in between 1 and 3 milligram per kilogram twice a day is a good starting dose. And it's a very wide range of doses. For what we were saying before, some dogs are very sensitive, and they might be sensitive for many different reasons. That can be, their body condition, the age, the underlying cause of the seizure. So there is no one dose that suits everyone, and the best is to start and to adjust the dose in response to how the patient is responding to the medication. These are the common side effects, and again, no. You can find these side effects everywhere, but it's just really to say that there are many reported, and owners often panic about this. So communication and tell them up front, particularly for the polyuria, polydipsia, polyphagia, maybe these attacks in coordination that can develop when you start the treatment. It saves you a lot of phone calls of a panicky owner that says that the dog looks terribly drunk or that he's drinking gallons. So just inform them about the common side effects, and then obviously there is a number of other side effects that have been reported. Most of the liver abnormalities are dose related, and certainly hepatotoxicity has been reported mostly with high serum levels of the drug. So I usually say no drug is 100% safe, and even if you were to take paracetamol every day, twice a day, you will probably have some consequences. So you really always have to balance risk and benefit of the medication and do the adequate monitoring. That means testing hematology biochemistry on a kind of regular basis, and would normally say ideally at least every 6 months in the ideal scenario, to make sure that there are no severe changes happening, and if there were, then you could make changes to the treatment sooner rather than later and reverse those changes. When we look at the laboratory changes, again, you would expect the liver enzyme to be elevated, usually because it increases the clearance of the thyroid and tissue metabolism of the thyroid. Then you might have low T4, and sometimes usually without the clinical signs of hypothyroidism. And also, it's too worth keeping in mind that it can cause some false positive to the low dose dexamethasone, again, because increase in the clearance of the dexamethasone. What about potassium bromide? Well, potassium bromide also, if we look at this picture, also works at the level of the GABA receptor, but what it does is essentially mimicking the chloride So it essentially increases the negativity inside the cells and raises the seizure threshold via these mechanisms. So still acts at the postsynaptic level. And the reported side effect, again, not dissimilar from the phenobarbital, but perhaps with a more pronounced ataxia potentially, particularly in the pelvic limbs, and again, PUPD polyphagia are not uncommon. To keep in mind is that potassium bromide is a salt, so it's not metabolized anywhere. Is ingested and excreted mostly through the kidneys unchanged, but it can be really irritating for the gastrointestinal tract. So some dogs might develop vomiting or diarrhea. And although we normally say that it's perfectly fine to give potassium bromide once a day because the half-life is so long, it makes really no difference. It might be not a bad idea to divide it twice a day purely because you reduce the amount and it might just be less irritating for the stomach. And again, there are a number of side effects that have been reported, also includes the pancreatitis. But what we really want to keep in mind, and we certainly would discourage the use of potassium bromide in cats because it has been associated with lower airways disease, a sort of almost like an allergic pneumonitis that could be fatal. So we would stay clear in cats of potassium bromide. And the main laboratory change that you can identify is that most laboratory assay cannot distinguish bromide from chloride, so you can have a very high chloride measurements that is actually artifactual, is testing bromide. One factor that is very important, like we're saying, bromide is mainly excreted by the kidneys and is a salt, so it is in competition with, for example, sodium chloride. And so diets that are rich in salt or the occasional giving egg and bacon on a Sunday might actually wipe away all the bromide that you've been giving to the patient. So it's very important for any patient that is potassium bromide to have a stable diet, and if the diet had to change for whatever reason, then they should really, the owner should really, really check that the level of sodium chloride are constant or very similar at least. And the same if you have to, you know, put on fluids, a patient that is on potassium bromide, is to keep in mind that that can wash out your potassium bromide. So certain fluids that contains chloride can really lower the serum level of potassium bromide. Last but not least is emipitoin of the licensed drug, and this is also acting at the same level, so GABA receptor, and is at the same level here, so we're still looking at a postsynaptic action. The difference compared to the barbiturates is that is only a partial agonist, and this means that it doesn't cause dependence, and that's why you can discontinue emipitoin much more quickly than you would be able to stop phenobarbital, for example. So it does not cause the dependence side effect. So these are the side effects that have been reported, and there is nothing really unusual. In fact, is often reported to have less side effect if we compare it to phenobarbital and potassium bromide. But there have been particularly hyperactivity, I think, has been quite you know, commonly reported in patients that were started on emipitoin, and it might be dose dependent. They might adapt with the moment you increase the dose, but it certainly is something to keep in mind. And the advantage of imipenem compared to the phenobarbital, for example, is that does not require a lot of monitoring, doesn't really cause the alteration on liver enzymes, and there is obviously no need for serum levels. So potentially, an easier drug to use. However, has also the limitation, and one of the limitation being that it's not really recommended for dogs that have a severe form of epilepsy, for example, so not for cluster seizures, was not being licensed for cluster seizures or for patients that have status epilepticus. So we would probably recommend using it in patients that have a naive form of epilepsy, perhaps not not a very severe form of. And of the second line drug, I'll just really briefly talk about the levetiracetam. And the mechanism of action is actually not completely understood. But if we look again at our picture here, of all the commonly used antiepileptic drug, is the only one that acts on a presynaptic, so it's working up here instead of the GABA receptor, and essentially works by stopping or preventing the release of the excitatory neurotransmitter glutamate, or prevent the fusion of the vesicles with the neurotransmitter. So it really prevents the seizure from happening, and it is very important thing to remember that levetiracetam works at a presynaptic level, because certainly it sound from a pharmacokinetic point of view a very good idea if you have to combine two medication to perhaps use a drug that works on the postsynaptic membrane and one that use the works on the presynaptic membrane, so to combine and to synergically try to use this drug together. Levetiracetam, again, like any other drug, can be used often. Is started a maintenance therapy, unless you need to do the loading. But we also use it as a pulse therapy, and I think more and more is being used as a pulse therapy. So particularly for dogs that have a severe form of seizures, or that they have the tendency of having clusters, we tend to just start it when the dog has the first seizure in the cluster, and loading even by mouth these patients, and then just carry on with the medication for 5 days, a week, sometimes less, just enough time to make sure that cluster is over. And then by using it in this way, we try to avoid the pharmacoresistance that has been reported associated with this drug. And there is a lot of work going on also in terms of using this medication at high or much higher doses than we use also as a maintenance therapy. And again, this would be to avoid this pharmacoresistance that might develop if you use the maintenance dose of levetiracetam over an extended period of time. The adverse effects are really, really uncommon. Sedation, ataxia certainly have been reported, but it seems to be a really benign drug to use. And one thing to keep in mind is that there have been some pharmacokinetic studies done in dogs on a combination of phenobarbital bromide and levetiracetam, and it seems that you really have to increase the dose of the levetiracetam if you're using it in combination with other drugs to guarantee the efficacy. Now, sometimes obviously treatment doesn't work, and I think it is always worth to pause and think about why did it not really work. And there are a number of reasons, and mine is not an exhaustive list by any means, but probably the one that I found more common are a poor owner or pet compliance, and so missing dosages certainly is a relatively common cause of treatment failure. Not giving enough medication, and that certainly might be help if you can test serum levels. Not for all drugs you need or you have to do it, so you might really want to play with the dose if there is an inadequate control of the seizures. Incorrect diagnosis, and I think this is What we were saying earlier about the labdo with the supposed diagnosis of idiopathic epilepsy, but we start the treatment and the seizure continue to get worse, and at that point we really want to rethink and potentially perform more investigation. It could still be that it's idiopathic epilepsy, just an extremely severe form of it, but you might just want at that stage to increase your level of confidence. And interference with the absorption, so concurrent conditions or concurrent drugs that can change either the absorption or the metabolism of the antiepileptic drugs. And also, unfortunately, a new disease, so a different disease, a patient that has idiopathic epilepsy, unfortunately, is not really. It's not impossible for this patient to also develop another central nervous system disease that might then cause seizures. So again, we always need to keep an open mind. And last but not least, and certainly the dreaded word for all people that have an interest in epilepsy, is the pharmacoresistance. So the brain just stop responding to the medication we're given. So can we stop antiepileptic treatment? And the answer, and again, this is a topic that also the Epilepsy Task Force have been discussing. And what they're saying is that yes, obviously it is possible. And the two main reasons would be remission of seizures. And there is unfortunately no great clarity about what remission is, but from personal experience, or my personal recommendation would be a minimum of 12 months seizure-free interval is what I would call remission of seizures. But you can find very different definitions for these, and of course, life-threatening adverse effect of the medication. So there are circumstances where we have to stop the antiepileptic drugs, and particularly really thinking of phenobarbital, well, for all really. And there are also other reasons to withdraw treatment. And certainly, if the cause of the seizure was initially a toxic or metabolic cause, and if we think at a short video you saw of the dog that went and scavenged into the compost bin and had an intoxication of a tremogenic mycotoxin, most likely, then once the seizure are controlled and once the dog is stable, then we can safely withdraw the treatment. Of course, if there has been a damage done potentially by the seizures, sometimes also by the metabolic insult to the brain, and that becomes a kind of structural form of epilepsy, no one really can predict up front. But certainly those group of patients are the one that at least is worth withdrawing medication if the seizure are completely disappeared, so if it's in complete seizure remission. And then also, if you had a structural cause of the seizure that could be addressed, and sometimes that could be hydrocephalus with a dog that underwent surgery, like a ventricular peritoneal shunting, a dog that had a head trauma and maybe needed a compressive surgery for a fragment that initially injured the brain. And again, we really need to be open-minded about these patients, because if there is a scar left in the brain, there is always the potential of the seizures reoccurring. So again, it's a very honest, open chat with the owners. You can always withdraw the treatment if the patient is seizure-free, but being prepared that it might be that the treatment might need to be reinitiated if the seizures represent. So these are just some guidelines. And it's also really worth thinking about which patients are more suitable. And overall, if we look at there are not a huge number of studies about withdrawing antiepileptic medications, but in a couple of studies, the evidence seems to point to the dogs relapsing, particularly if they were having idiopathic epilepsy or cryptogenic, so not an identifiable cause for the seizures. But within the one that were in remission, within the group of patients that are more likely, let's say, to go in remission from seizures, we have female neutered dogs, and also patients that are slightly older at the time of the onset of seizures seems to have a higher likelihood to go into seizure remission, and not having a history of cluster seizures, and unfortunately not being a border collie, not being a German Shepherd, and not being a Staffy seems to be factors that increase the likelihood of seizure remission. In these studies, most dogs where the anti-epileptic treatment was reduced or withdrawn experienced a relapse of the seizures, and they were started on either increased treatment again or started treatment again. But it is always a possibility, and I think we really have to take it on a case to case basis more than generalize. So just really a few points to end this webinar. It's important to keep in mind that seizures are symptoms. And we said before, we should never really stop to the idea that, you know, we diagnose the patient with seizures. We certainly need to identify if what we're dealing with are seizures or episodes of other origin. But once we decided that it is a seizure, then we should really dig and find the underlying cause for those seizures. And it's very important to set out the diagnostic plan, not just based on our pattern recognition, but also according to this clinical, so a slightly more analytical type of reasoning, and also being self-conscious and mindful that if things don't follow the pattern that we were expecting, perhaps we should be rethinking our diagnostic process. So having that flexibility always in mind to eventually change plan if needed be. And then realize that there is no treatment that suits everyone, and we all have our favorite drugs, and we are all, you know, very comfortable using those drugs. And even for this reason, I think we all know that not all dogs respond in the same way to those medications. So we really have to individualize the treatment, both in terms of the dose or the type of drug that we're using and how many drugs we use in those patients. And then I cannot stress enough, really, the communication with the owners, because they are ultimately the one that give the tablet, have a emotional and financial involvement with this condition, and it's very, very important to keep them in the loop with anything, pros and cons and everything else, because that I think is a key point in just working well together. And this is all for me. Of course, if you have any question, I'll be happy to take them now, and thank you very much for attending.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alberta for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.